You know what time it is. It's time to ask a spaceman. I'm Paul Sutter. You've got questions. I've got answers. You know how this show works, but I'm going to let you know anyway. You go on Twitter, you go on Facebook, use the hashtag AskASpaceman and ask whatever comes to mind, as long as it's about space. And I'll pick questions to answer on this show. You can also follow me directly on Facebook and post your questions. I'm on Facebook as Paul Matt Sutter. Sutter like butter, but with an S. That's my name. Same thing on Twitter. Or you can go to askaspaceman.com. There you'll find the show notes. You can have some discussion and you can ask your questions there. We want a very simple thing with this show. Complete knowledge of time and space. It's going to take a while, but we're in no hurry. We'll do it one topic at a time. And today's topic, this is a question I got when I was recently doing a public outreach event at a science museum here. I was talking about something else, and some kid came up to me. He was maybe 6 or 7 years old, and he just said, "Hey, where do oceans come from?" And I know you're thinking, "Hey, space guy, last time I checked, oceans are here on Earth, so what are you doing answering that question?" Well, spoiler alert, buddy, the ocean... Oh no, wait. I already used the spoiler alert joke in an episode a couple back. Okay, I got... How about I just call you a knucklehead? So you asked, "Hey, space dude, last time I checked, the ocean's here on Earth, so why are you answering the question?" Well, guess what, knucklehead? The answer is space. Oceans come from space. And so that's how I get to talk about where the oceans come from, because the answer is space. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and so we need a whole episode to talk about it. In fact, there's very little actual water in the solar system. We see these big giant oceans and they seem massive, and they do. They stretch literally from horizon to horizon, but they take up like less than 0.1% of the total mass of the Earth. And we always forget, I think, just how big the Earth really is. And these massive oceans are like a tiny, tiny thin film, like a plastic wrap around the giant Earth. There's a whole lot of water buried in the Earth, around maybe 1% of the total mass of the Earth is water underground. And I don't want you to think that there's like giant underground oceans and rivers. It's more like little individual water molecules scattered here and there, almost like a wet sponge, except the sponge is made of rock. Okay, but that's where most of the water on the Earth is, and it's some tiny fraction of the total mass of the Earth. Now, oceans are made of water. I hope you all understand that already. The oceans are made of water, and water itself is made of two elements, hydrogen and oxygen. That's the H and the O. Yes, you should know this already. At least some of you paid attention in chemistry class. Now, hydrogen in the universe is everywhere. I mean, most of the universe is made of hydrogen. It was formed in the very, very early universe. That's a cool show on its own if anyone wants to ask that question. So there's just tons of hydrogen. In fact, most of the universe, most of our solar system even, is hydrogen, because most of the mass, if you add up everything in our solar system, our sun takes up most of the mass. Almost everything that's in the solar system is in the sun, and almost everything that's in the sun is made of hydrogen. But what about oxygen? Oxygen is actually pretty common. Remember when we talked about the death of the sun? I believe it was episode 2 or 3. And in the fusion processes in stars, stars are constantly fusing hydrogen to helium and then helium onto heavier things. One of those heavier things is oxygen. So actually, as things go in the universe, oxygen is pretty common. And chemically, hydrogen and oxygen make really good buddies. They love to hang out together. And so you actually see water pretty much everywhere. We've got water here on Earth. There's some ice water on the moon. There's ice all over asteroids and comets. In fact, you know, we think of comets as being dirty snowballs or snowy dirt balls, but whatever the case, there's ice, there's water on it. There might have been water on Mars. There might be some water underground in Mars still today. There's the moon of Jupiter, Europa, which we talked about with the aliens and the potential for life on other planets. There's maybe a whole ocean. There's hundreds of miles thick ice sheet covering the moon of Europa. There's entire clouds of mostly ice particles sitting in the outskirts of the solar system. There's water everywhere, not a drop to drink, but there's water. Water is actually one of the most common compounds found throughout the universe. You know, after hydrogen, helium, and all the usual stuff, water's pretty common. You just need to get water into ball form. You just need to get it from floating around in space when it's formed from the death of a massive star and it blows out, spews out all sorts of stuff, including water. You just have to get it to coat a planet like Earth to give us the oceans. And this is a really good question. This is a question I love to answer, the kind of question I love to answer, because the answer of how you get water from being dispersed, cloudy, all over the place in space to oceans on a planet is we actually don't really know. We have some good ideas, but this is actually a pretty complicated physical process. And so I love reaching into topics and exploring topics where we don't fully understand everything that's going on. We don't fully understand these processes. And I'll talk about the various ideas, but I want you to keep that in mind that no, even with all of our sophistication and our computer modeling and our expensive satellites and telescopes and brilliant people thinking about it for decades and even centuries, there's some things about our universe and the evolution of our universe that we're still figuring out. Even things that might appear to be simple, like where do the oceans come from? So the story of the Earth's oceans starts with the story of the formation of the Earth in the solar system itself. You start off, and again, this is a topic we're not 100% sure how things like the solar system form. And so, but this is our best guess. This is our best story we have that fits the evidence. There's still a lot of missing pieces to the jigsaw. You start off with some cloud of gas. Some blob of gas that's just hanging out. It was blown out by earlier supernova or other processes, and you've got this big nebula hanging out. And most of it, like I said, is hydrogen and helium. There's a few heavier elements, and when an astronomer says heavy, they really mean anything heavier than helium. So you have this cloud of gas. Now what? You have to turn this cloud of gas into a solar system. So you need something to trigger it, something to initiate a new phase in its evolution. Otherwise, it's just going to hang out being a cloud of gas forever. And we've studied radioactive isotopes in the Earth and in asteroids on the moon and everything. And it looks like that triggering, what started the process off of turning this cloud of gas into a solar system, was a nearby supernova. A supernova went off, sent shockwaves through this gas, and that kind of started mixing things up and setting things in motion. And most stars form in nurseries where there's a giant cloud of gas that supports hundreds or even thousands of stars. And some stars form right away and are really massive and very quickly go into the supernova stage and blow up. And other stars form after or about the same time, but they're smaller, so they last a little bit longer. They're a little bit more serene. And it's thought that our sun formed in a similar nursery, a stellar nursery. It had a few hundred or a few thousand siblings. Some of them had wild and crazy lives and blew up right away, and that triggered a little patch of this gas cloud to start collapsing and mixing and doing its thing. Eventually, over time, the stars that form from this gas cloud disperse and go on their merry ways to explore the galaxy. But the physics of getting this gas cloud into becoming a solar system are really, really complex. There's lots of things going on. There's turbulence, there's radiation, there's magnetic fields, there's all sorts of different chemical compositions and interplay between them. It's a really tough physics problem, an astrophysics problem. That's what makes it so hard to fully understand this process. Is it's just really hard physics to figure out. But we do know that you can get from a cloud of gas to a disk. You know, the solar system is pretty much on a nice thin plane, and you can get that from a big amorphous cloud of gas pretty easily. And that's if the cloud of gas is spinning, which if there's a shockwave or whatever from a supernova nearby, that shockwave is going to start that gas cloud spinning. And you have two competing forces. You have gravity that's trying to compress the ball of gas in more and more and more. And you also have the spinning. So you have like centrifugal forces or centripetal acceleration, like sitting on a merry-go-round, you want to be spun outwards. So there's two competing forces in this ball of gas that's spinning. You have gravity that's trying to pull you in and down towards the center. And you have the centrifugal force or centripetal acceleration, which is trying to push you away or out. Like if you were sitting on a merry-go-round, you want to go out. And so you have competing. You have gravity doing in and down towards the center. And against that, you have something pushing you out. Well, the out cancels out the in, but you're still left with the down. So if you start with this big cloud of gas and start it spinning, the in and out forces balance each other out, but you're still left with something pulling you down. And so over time, this cloud of gas, as it's spinning, becomes a disk. And it's what we call a protoplanetary disk. It's from this disk that things like the Earth will eventually form and coalesce. And at the center, we have the proto-sun, the proto-star, what the cloud of gas, the chunk of gas that's eventually going to compress enough to ignite nuclear fusion and become a star. And here's where it gets even more complicated, because you have gas floating around, you have some bits of rocks floating around, they're a little bit sticky, so they stick together, but as soon as they stick together, they get slammed apart right away. It's a debris field, it's messy. There's lots of protoplanets and quasi-planets. Their orbits are changing all the time because they're interacting like crazy. They get formed, they get broken up, they get suffered from massive collisions that just break them apart again. It's a really, really messy time. And at the same time, the sun itself is going through variable stages. Sometimes it's really bright, sometimes it's really dim. It's like the nuclear motor at its center is still having trouble getting going, getting started. So it sputters out sometimes and it flares back up and more gas accretes on the star and it goes off again. It flies off. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on. There's slamming and jamming. It's like an interplanetary mosh pit trying to get planets to form. And that's why we're not 100% sure of how exactly the process of planet formation occurs, because again, it's just so dang messy. But we do know that in the inner parts of the solar system, where somewhere like the Earth is, it's really too hot for water. the sun is really stinking bright, especially close to it. And any water that might have just been carried along with the little rocks as they start gluing together to form the Earth, the water would just get evaporated. It would melt and turn to gas and it'd be pushed out of the inner solar system. It's only in the outer solar system where you get kind of the original ice that formed with the solar system, because it's cold enough for there to be ice instead of just liquid water or just gaseous water. So the water on the Earth had to come from somewhere. And there's a bunch of ideas out there, and I'll run through them and kind of paint a picture of what some of the ideas are. And there may be different possibilities, different combinations of possibilities. Maybe one process contributed more than the other. We really don't know. It's a sticky problem. One idea is that the water that we see on the oceans today actually did come along with all those protoplanets and bits of rock. And as the sun heated them up, the water kind of evaporated out and escaped the rocks. But by then, the Earth already had an atmosphere, and that kind of kept a lid on things. It kept the pressure high enough that the water tries to seep out and says, okay, I'm out of here. I'm gone. It's too hot for me. But the atmosphere says, nope, you're sticking to the Earth like a pressure cooker. The heat of the stove is trying to make water escape from whatever you're cooking, but you have a tight lid on it. And so it keeps it in the food and makes it nice and juicy and tender. So maybe just the Earth was pressure cookered, and the oceans that we see today came from the rocks that formed the Earth. Another possibility is that the atmosphere formed too late in order to keep a lid on all the water that was outgassing from the Earth and seeping out of the rocks. And so after the Earth formed, a bunch of comets swung by, came in from the outer solar system. Remember, it's crazy time, so there's migration, there's lots of collisions. And they just slammed into the Earth one after another, and each one dumped a bucket of water on the Earth, or a comet-sized bucket of water on the Earth. And after hundreds or thousands or even millions of collisions, you build up the oceans that we see today. Another possibility is that Jupiter's forming outside the asteroid belt, and its gravity is acting like a big old baseball bat, and it's just lobbing asteroids into the inner solar system. As it swings by, there happens to be an unlucky asteroid, and just whack, sends it flying into the inner solar system. That asteroid has lots of ice on it, lots of water, and it slams into the Earth just like the comets do, but now it's coming from the inner solar system, from the asteroid belt, instead of way out from the Oort cloud or Kuiper belt where the comets come from. And that's seeding water on the Earth. That's filling up the basins and what will become the oceans. Another idea is that the minerals that make up the mantle of the Earth, you know, I gave this analogy, there's lots of water in there, it's like a wet sponge, maybe they're a little bit leaky, and that the initial water that was on the surface of the Earth when it formed evaporated and went away, but slowly over time, as the Earth compressed and congealed and solidified, it was almost like the sponge was squeezed and some water just made it out onto the surface to make the oceans. Another possibility is that when the moon was formed, and we think the moon was formed when something the size of like Mars slammed into the proto-Earth and chucked a bunch of material out into orbit around the Earth, and that's what created the moon, you'll notice that the moon is a little bit weird when it comes to inner solar system. The only other planet inside the asteroid belt with any moons at all is Mars, and it's just got these two rinky-dink asteroids that just happened to capture, got lucky. Nobody else has a giant moon like we do in the inner solar system. And so it's thought that it came from the Earth itself, that the Earth was much larger, got slammed by one of its buddies sharing its orbit. The other planet was obliterated, and we're left with the Earth and the moon that we have today. And maybe that massive collision took a lot of the water that was kind of trapped in the inner core and allowed it to escape to the surface. By then, we did have an atmosphere so it could keep the water pressurized and keep it liquid. That's one possibility. A slightly more crazier possibility is that early life generated water. We're used to photosynthesis. This is the process that plants use to get energy from sunlight. But there's other ways of getting energy from the environment and from sunlight. And one of these paths, one of these ways of getting energy out of sunlight involves the creation of water. It's a byproduct of this process. The normal process that we know of as photosynthesis has carbon dioxide as a byproduct, but it's not too crazy to have dihydrogen monoxide, two hydrogens and an oxygen combined in this process. And so maybe early life didn't use the process that's used today, but used this earlier process and just like spit out water. And that was enough to fill out the oceans. And then other kinds of life come along for that use the traditional photosynthetic pathways for making energy. And we're left with all this extra water laying around on the earth. Some of these ideas are discouraged by evidence. Some of them are less so. We can test it kind of by looking at the ratios of radioactive elements in the water and comparing that to samples of water in comets and asteroids and on the moon, so we can try to get a guess of what is the source of the water on the earth. Now, it's not the best strategy because ocean water has gone through a lot of evolution over the past few billion years since the earth formed, but it's one of the only things we got. So that's what we're going to go with. These kind of tests tend to favor the asteroid hypothesis, where Jupiter is lobbing asteroids onto an early Earth, but it's not really settled. This is still a pretty open question. We haven't really nailed it down and said this is how oceans get on the Earth. There aren't really any clear answers. And so that's the state of things. We're just going to have to wait a little bit for complete knowledge of time and space, for some more people to study it, more people to figure out. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed listening to this show. I love the feedback I'm getting already. You guys are great. You're having a great community, great discussions. Thanks for all the questions. I'll get to some of them in the upcoming episodes. Again, you can go to Twitter or Facebook, use the hashtag AskASpaceman. You can ask me directly, follow me directly at PaulMattSutter or Facebook.com/PaulMattSutter. You can go to the website, AskASpaceman.com. And there, if you want, there's a little button on the website that says subscribe. If you think it's worth it, send some money into space. Why not? It helps keep this show going. If you don't think it's worth it, then why don't you do it anyway? Because you're a really nice person. And tell your friends about the show, if you could. Tell your friends of friends. Tell your family. Tell your dog. Don't tell your cat, because I don't think your cat would care. But tell everyone else about the show. I think this kind of show needs a community. It needs not just an audience. It's in back and forth. I want to hear your feedback. I want to hear your questions. I want to know what you're curious about. And I want to talk to you and have that conversation. So thanks a lot for listening. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.